Even as the publishing industry converges in Frankfurt, Germany for the world's largest annual book fair, the news keeps breaking elsewhere. In Stockholm, the Nobel Committee has awarded the prize in literature to Chinese author Mo Yan. And in a New York courtroom, the Authors Guild gets the bare facts on fair use from Judge Harold Bear. Welcome, everyone, to Copyright Clearance Center's podcast series. My name is Christopher Keneally, host of Beyond the Book, and every week we turn to the writers and editors of Publishers Weekly for a look at the week ahead, a preview of the news that everyone in publishing is talking about. Joining me from the floor of the Frankfurt Book Fair is Andrew Albanese, the magazine's features editor, and welcome back, Andrew.
Greetings from Germany, Chris.
Well, it's great to have you join us. Appreciate you taking the time. I realize it's been a whirlwind for you already, and you're only about halfway through. And as you half-jokingly predicted last week, there was indeed a very important decision in a New York courtroom, not the one in the case that so many people have heard about, the Google Books case, but in a very separate case, but a related one. Tell us about it.
Yeah, and you know, I wasn't even half joking. I was full on joking that this decision would come down while I was in Germany, and here we are. And I apologize if you know, that hum you may hear. I don't know if you hear it or not, but it's a very busy floor here at Frankfurt, which is a great thing. But anyway, yes, Google and the HathiTrust. So the big news that came out this week was that Judge Harold Bear granted the defendant's motion for summary judgment on the issue of fair use. Judge Bear, and what that really means is that Judge Bear found the arguments made at the summary judgment stage of this trial to be so compelling that he awarded the HathiTrust a victory without even going to trial. We had always known this was a possibility, but I don't think we really expected it, and yet here it is. In the end score, the judge seemed to not even really think it was much of a case for the Authors Guild. He rejected their claims and accepted the HathiTrust's claims of fair use here. And he had some pretty strong words, I have to say, in the ruling in defense of fair use. It's a bit of an interesting case because we're talking about mass digitization. But the judge, in looking back on this, didn't even blink at the idea of mass digitization. And his final conclusion, he basically said that he could not imagine a definition of fair use that would cause him to shut down a program like the HathiTrust that had such beneficial works to aspects to society. So a pretty awful defeat for the Authors Guild and a pretty great win for libraries, fair use, and for advocates of digitization.
Well, you know, this is a good opportunity to mention to listeners that you have a new colleague at PW, a name they'll be familiar with if they do follow these kinds of cases. James Grimmelman, who's a professor of law at the New York Law School, will now be blogging for PW. He already blogs on his own site called The Laboratorium, and he is an attorney. Neither one of us is, Andrew. He's already made some early comments on this. Can you briefly tell us about those?
Yeah, that's right. So I'm delighted to welcome James. James has been a great source and a great resource for me, and it's been fantastic working and talking with him over the past years of this Google settlement, and I'm delighted that we're going to have his thoughts featured regularly in Publishers Weekly. It should be great for our readers to have his take on stuff. James and I had conversation, you know, from Germany here, and he basically told me what I think he's pretty much told the world at this point, which is that he considers this case to be a pretty serious blow to the Authors Guild in their case against Google. Basically, even though Google, obviously, the case against the Authors Guild and Google has stayed right now while they decide a procedural issue. But the fair use case, the fair use issue has been reached by Judge Harold Bear. And it's such a striking fair use ruling here that it's definitely going to influence that litigation. Now, Google, of course, is a commercial venture and the HathiTrust is a non-commercial venture. But nevertheless, the fair use analysis does cut into the Authors Guild's claims in the Google case. As James says, this is a pretty serious blow to the Authors Guild, and it seems like an appropriate time for them to take stock of the litigation, ask what it's accomplished for their memberships, and consider the consequences of what pressing on would be. So I think there are some tough choices looming ahead for the Authors Guild in this litigation against Google.
Well, last week we reported that the publishers had announced their own settlement out of court with Google to end their case, the one that they were sort of in tandem with the Authors Guild on, leaving the Authors Guild on its own. What chances, and this is speculation, obviously, but what chances do you think that the Guild might want to settle or try for another settlement? Of course, there was the original settlement proposed in 2008, so this would be settlement redux, but what chances are, do you think, that the Guild may move in that direction?
You know, I have almost done trying to predict what the Authors Guild is going to do at certain stages, but I would certainly think that they would have a strong incentive to come up with some kind of settlement, and a settlement along the lines of what the publishers did last week. Now, the publishers' settlement is barely a settlement, in my opinion. It's more or less the publishers have abandoned the suit, have sort of dropped the suit. As Jonathan Band told me last week, it sure looks like the publishers just kind of threw in the towel. And that's not as bad as it might sound, throwing in the towel, because I think one thing the publishers realized is that all of the doom that they had predicted, all of the nervousness they had about what Google was doing, digitizing these back volumes and making them searchable, it never really came to pass. I think 7 years after the initial litigation was filed, they realized that there was a lot of potential benefit here. There wasn't a lot to gain from winning the litigation, and that, you know, it really wasn't going to cause them that much harm. I think the Authors Guild at this point has to realize that it's very much in the same position and should probably look towards coming to a settlement. And one of the reasons why is because if they go into court with this fair use verdict already looming over them and they lose in that case in Judge Chin's courtroom, they're going to be on the line for potentially paying Google's legal fees. And I don't even want to know what those fees would look like after 7 years of litigation. So I think the impetus to settle for the Authors Guild is pretty strong right now.
Well, a fascinating analysis, Andrew. And, you know, we can talk about the Google cases almost every week, but we can only talk about Frankfurt once a year. So there you are on the floor, just day one officially. We are recording this on Thursday. What's been the scene so far, and what's your takeaways as far as how different a fair 2012 is from those in the last couple of years?
Well, you know, it's been a very strong fair this year. The traffic has been great in Hall A. The traffic's been great in the other halls as well. I think the buzzwords overall for me this year have been global, and the word ecosystem seems to be popping up here a lot now. The global theme began really on Tuesday with the morning keynotes at the Tools of Change conference, when there was a great presentation from Joe Henry of Bowker, who released more data from a survey that's coming out in November about consumers' attitudes towards ebooks. And as you might guess, consumers all around the world are really sort of adopting ebooks. And that's really opening a lot of opportunity to publishers. Now, there's some disruption, of course, that's going to come along with that. But by and large, the mood is really quite optimistic about this phenomenal new audience for reading, this global audience for reading that's coming out. But I think the biggest change that I've noticed at Frankfurt this year, which is good and bad, is that it's much more, the professional program here is much more nuts and bolts. You know, for the past 3 or 4 years, as digital was, you know, sort of growing up, it was sort of in its infancy in terms of ebooks, we had these great panels with these wonderful speakers and thinkers who were almost philosophizing about the wonders of digital and everything that was going to do. Well, this year, it's very noticeably yielded to all-day workshops on licensing, big, long, dedicated programs to metadata and EPUB and other standards and HTML5 and marketing and some very nitty-gritty digital topics. We're no longer talking about what digital can do. We're talking about how you're doing it and how to go about doing it. Now, where that's bad is for me, because I used to love writing those stories about these great philosophers. They made for great copy and they always had some great stuff. And, you know, it's a little less engaging for me to write about EPUB or, you know, HTML5, as fascinating and interesting as it is, as it was to quote, say, you know, Evan Schnittman or some of the great thinkers who were really out front here in years past.
Well, you know, you still had at least one big opportunity to do that. There was a CEO panel that attracted a fair amount of attention. And what did we learn from publishers as to how they are viewing this point in the digital transition, in particular, how they look at Apple and Amazon?
Yeah, you know, there was a great opening panel right at 9:45 in the opening day of the show. It was moderated by Richard Mollett, who's the CEO of the Publishers Association. And it featured, you know, Richard Sharkin and Matt Hanbury from Murdoch Books and George Lossius. Now, all of those guys are great speakers and great thinkers. But what I liked about this panel was that it didn't try to take digital lessons from, you know, the music industry, which has really been sort of a fun thing to do in the past. You know, what lessons can we learn from the music industry? Well, Mollett started from the point of view that the publishing industry transition to digital is no longer in its infancy. It's in, as he said, the voting and drinking stage of adolescence, or of early adulthood. And so they decided to take a look back and talk about, you know, take lessons from themselves. And one of the big lessons that all three publishers tended to agree on is that, you know, if they could go back and do it again, they wouldn't be pushed around so much by these by Apple and Amazon, some of these big providers that have really pushed their way into the space. As Matt Hanbury said, you know, he called the deals atrocious that some of the publishers made. There was really some hand-wringing over what he called ridiculous levels of discounts for the tasks that the Apple and Amazon provides. And Hanbury said it just bedeviled them that these big international publishing companies made these atrocious deals back then. Now, of course, hindsight is always 20/20, and you know the publishers made the deals, you know, what they had to do. They did what they had to do at the time. But I think that there was a real sense among the publishing community that in the next phase of the digital revolution, they're going to try to take some of that control back.
Well, you know, that might be a little bit of wishful thinking. It certainly, I think, signals a realization that the ground has shifted underneath them and that these players, Apple and Amazon particularly, are very much taking the dominant role.
That's true. And you know, one of the great things about Frankfurt is that in America, we often talk about Amazon and Apple as if, you know, Google too, as if they're the only players. But on the international stage, you know, they're not quite as dominant. Amazon isn't in a lot of countries in Europe. You know, Apple is not the most popular phone in Europe either. In fact, it's not even the most popular phone worldwide. You know, Android is very popular here. You know, there was a Global 50 survey that we do that is done by Hachette-Livre in France with the publishing consultant Rudiger Wieschenbart in PW as well. And every year there's a Global 50 panel where they have CEOs from the big publishers come on and talk about, you know, their rankings that ranks the top 50 publishers in the world. Well, this year they went ahead and brought in CEOs from these major digital platforms. And it was really quite fascinating because they all spoke about the opportunity that now is really out there to reach this global audience with your product. You know, sure, there are challenges and territoriality and issues like that. But, you know, the ebook market has really begun to change and offer these publishers opportunities that they would never had 2 or 3 years ago. Michael Cervinas was especially good on this panel. He's the CEO of Kobo. And he said that he looks at this as the beginning of a 25-year cycle. You know, so they're definitely taking the long term. Now, a lot of people thought that, you know, they were crazy, Kobo, when they launched this little Canadian company that was going to try to sell in all these countries, he said. But they've gone out and built a partner model. You know, they brought in booksellers to work with them, and I think that's pretty unique in the industry. One of his partners, you know, from France, Elodie Protizot, who's the director of books for French retailer Fnac, offered great insight. She said, you know, it's no longer a matter of global expansion, but to stay competitive in your own national market, you need to be as competitive as the global actors. In other words, if you want to stay on top of your own national book market, you have to either partner with a global partner or you have to develop that technology to be global yourself. I thought that was a really fantastic insight.
Well, indeed, Andrew, it seems like you've been paying close attention. A fascinating point, too, regarding the global perspective that you get there in Frankfurt. We've been chatting with Andrew Albanese at the Frankfurt Book Fair. He is the features editor for Publishers Weekly. He talks to us every week on our podcast series. Andrew, thanks so much and have a great week.
Pleasure, Chris.
Now I want to fly across the ocean and go back to the offices of Publishers Weekly in New York City and turn to Samuel R. Slayton, reviews editor there at PW. Sam, welcome back to Beyond the Book.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Well, it's nice to have you join us again this week. You're doing the review of reviews, and what have we got in fiction?
We start with a review of Ayanna Mathis's remarkable debut novel, The 12 Tribes of Hattie, which traces the life of Hattie Shepherd through the eyes of her offspring, ultimately depicting a family whose members are distant, fiercely proud, and desperate for connection with their mother. In the course of doing this, the novel also traces much of the 20th century, especially as it relates to the struggles of an African-American family. As Hattie's children age, they come to terms with their intense need for and resentment of the mother who kept them alive but starved their hearts. Mathis, a graduate of the Iowa Writers' Workshop who studied with Marilyn Robinson, weaves this story with confidence and grace. And the more experimental Encyclopedia of a Life in Russia is a formerly audacious novel by Jose Manuel Prieto, divided into 26 chapters organized from A to Z, after a prologue, called Encyclopedia, introduces first-person narrator Thelonious Monk, not the music legend, as he arrives in Russia. Chapters are broken into mock, though actually insightful, encyclopedia entries that conform to each letter and include numerous references to other entries, urging readers to flip back and forth and creating an ever-deepening picture of the whole. We called it, quote, truly quirky and consistently surprising. We also have a Q&A with Icelandic author Andri Magnusson, who laments the world's energy crisis and failing environmental policies in every project he touches. When we talked to the author about Love Star, his latest wild and fictional manifesto, he said that, quote, the book is a tribute to ideas. We take every idea and go to the extreme. In the past, that has happened to almost every ideology, religion, technocracy, fascism, communism, corporations. Google fences keeping out reality within certain limits. Endless marketing opportunities changing our interactions into commodities. Everyone becomes his own big brother. Rather scary thought.
Well, indeed. And you know, Sam, I'm somewhat familiar with Iceland. And so the notion of going to extremes is something the Icelandic people are at home with. It's a country of extremes, from volcanoes to glaciers. Moving now to mysteries and thrillers, there are some killers on the loose across the ages.
Once again, in Andrew Clavin's taut, frightening psychological thriller, A Killer in the Wind, New York State Deputy Dan Champion tries to find a criminal who may not exist. Meanwhile, Dan has visions of a beautiful redhead, Samantha, who turns up on a riverbank semi-conscious with an enigmatic message for him. Quote, they're coming after us. Michael Jex's 31st Knights Templar mystery, City of Fiends, is a textbook example of how to blend action and detection in a historical. The complex truth behind the suspicious death of Bishop Berkeley, whose brother is the jailer of the deposed Edward II, and the savage murder of a maid will leave readers satisfied. We do also have a Q&A with Ed Kovacs, who I believe you mentioned on last week's review of the reviews. He's the author of Good Junk, his second novel featuring P.I. Cliff St. James in post-Katrina New Orleans.
In science fiction, there's a novel of big ideas from Stephen Utley.
That's right. In Invisible Kingdoms, Stephen Utley's second collection, The 400 Million Year Itch of his Silurian... Sorry, I messed that one up too.
And I called it a novel, so let's just... let's both fix our errors. Okay. In science fiction, there's a collection that tackles some very big ideas, although they're supposedly unseen, at least in the title. Stephen Utley has something out.
We have a review of Invisible Kingdoms, Utley's second collection after The 400 Million Year Itch of his Silurian Tales. Presented in a chronological order, 15 stories and novellas continue the ongoing narrative of a scientific expedition that has traveled through a space-time anomaly to the Earth of 400 million years ago, during the Paleozoic era. Utley focuses on an ever-changing cast of scientists and creative types, using them as mouthpieces to debate politics, religion, parallel universe theory, love, environmentalism, and other weighty matters. There's an understated disdain for big business, a melancholy yearning for a pristine world, and a keen understanding of human nature running throughout the stories, many of which are linked only by shared characters. Playing with the many worlds hypothesis, Utley hints at a much larger picture without giving straight answers. No aspect of the premise goes unconsidered in these intelligent, provocative, character and concept-driven tales, making this collection a treat for readers in need of a challenge. Ronald Malfi's The Morning House is a masterfully crafted tale for fans of literary horror. Sam Hatch has it all: friends, a successful career, a blissful marriage, until a car accident, with Sam at the wheel, kills his wife and infant daughter. Haunted by memories and guilt, and, quote, some separate, indescribable urge, Sam drifts aimlessly until reaching a vacant shell of a house on the Chesapeake Bay that he feels compelled to buy. But strange things keep happening inside. A child's nonsensical babbling emanates from the pipes. The windows and roof shift and bulge, and things move behind the walls. Outside, everyone has forgotten the house exists, except for local waitress Karen Kilstow, who tells Sam to be careful. The house bites, literally. Lyrical prose creates an atmosphere of eerie claustrophobia, flawless pacing, and a plot that unfolds into a quietly shattering climax.
That sounds very unsettling, I must say, Sam. But much more comfortable is something we've got in Time for Fall, two rakish romances.
Readers who enjoyed last year's Ripe for Scandal will love Isabel Carr's newest, Ripe for Seduction, a frivolous wager among a rakish group of friends in 1785 London over who can bed Lady Olivia Carlo quickly turns serious. As Roland DeVere wakes up from a wild night to discover that the lady in question has accepted his drunken marriage proposal, Olivia forces Roland to pretend they really are betrothed, at the same time as his sister Margot pursues an affair with Olivia's father. Carr balances her character's romantic adventures with genuine heart, making the double love story a delightful and erotic page-turner. Historical romance fans will also enjoy Waking Up with a Rake, the first collaboration between Connie Mason and Mia Marlowe. Power brokers in 1818 England enlist Lord Rhys Warrington to seduce Olivia Simon before she can marry the Duke of Clarence and allow him to inherit the throne from his brother, the Prince Regent. As Rhys gains Olivia's trust, he unexpectedly finds himself falling in love with her. He also discovers she is being targeted for murder. Romance veteran Mason and newcomer Marlowe serve up spicy love scenes as the backdrop to an alluring read, complete with an outspoken female protagonist and a hint of mystery.
Well, you know, the image of the rake from old time England is a wonderful one. I was just thinking that if you ever had a genie there and he asked you what you wanted to be, you'd say, I want to make me a rake. You'd have to be very careful that the genie made you the right sort of rake. All right, in nonfiction, it's been a good year for Frankenstein.
Like John Gardner's 1971 novel Grendel, wherein the author reimagined the early English lit staple Beowulf from the perspective of its antagonist, Dave Zeltzerman recast Dr. Frankenstein's creation as his narrative lead in Monster, a novel published earlier this year. Last month, we gave a starred review to Susan Wolfson and Ronald Leveo's The Annotated Frankenstein. And in next week's issue, we have a starred review of Roseanne Montillo's first nonfiction book, The Lady and Her Monsters, a tale of dissections, real-life Dr. Frankensteins, and the creation of Mary Shelley's masterpiece, a macabre romp through 18th and 19th century Europe that illuminates the circumstances and inspiration behind one of Gothic literature's most notorious tales. Walking a fine line between historical fact and logical conjecture, the book deftly weaves details of Mary Shelley's early life into the cultural and scientific map of the time she was writing. Grim body snatchers, cadaver-carving surgeons, and nefarious alchemists litter the pages of this enticing read. Building off a story published in Mother Jones in 2011, itself based on the author's tenure as an investigative reporting fellow at UC Berkeley, Trevor Aronson's The Terror Factory presents convincing evidence of the FBI's role in seeding terrorist plots in order to foil them and claim the honors. Aronson, the associate director and co-founder of the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting, demonstrates how Hoover's prodigal brainchild, quote, built the largest network of spies, many of them serial crooks and ex-cons, ever seen in the U.S. in an effort to lure hapless outliers into trumped-up sting operations. The author cites a list provided by the U.S. Attorney General's office enumerating 400 people prosecuted as terrorists since the 9/11 attacks. Aronson alleges that many of these cases are the result of what amounts to wholesale entrapment of individuals recruited with government funds and expertise. He writes, "While we have captured a few terrorists since 9/11, we have manufactured many more." From the founder of the Storefront School of Life, a British alternative education organization, comes How to Think More About Sex, an accessible philosophical meditation on topics like biological and physiological reactions to sex, fetishes, fashion, the subjectivity of beauty, impotency, sexual rejection, pornography, adultery, and more. Alain de Botton is never prescriptive, and the intellectual rigor of his investigation prevents this illuminating book from settling into a self-help reference guide. After all, his aim is to guide readers in how to think about sex in a different way, not to teach them how to have it.
We also have reviews of two interesting photography collections.
Digging through the unprecedented treasure trove of tens of thousands of images that Vivian Meyer, a private street photographer who never shared her work in her lifetime, Richard Cahan and Michael Williams have unearthed a beautiful, haunting collection of a private woman and gifted artist, as seen in the new collection, Vivian Meyer, Out of the Shadows. Accompanying essays provide vital detail on Meyer's life as a background for her art, though the writing borders on melodrama at times. However, the more than 200 photos here carry a beauty that aches. The collection's only and forgivable flaw is that of leaving a viewer wanting to see more of Meyer's work. Famed fashion photographer Tim Walker shares a new 170-image collection, Tim Walker Storyteller, assembled from the world's most famous magazines, including Vogue, Vanity Fair, W, and The New Yorker, a follow-up to 2008's Pictures, timed to coincide with a major exhibition at Somerset House in London. Aided by an introduction by Robin Muir, a foreword by Kate Bush, and Walker's own afterword, these extravagantly choreographed, fantastical images never fail to deliver a jolt. They are usually disconcerting and often have a wonderful sense of humor and play.
And that very same sensibility is on display in several children's books that you've got for us this week.
Yeah, in picture books, we have the latest from Caldecott medalist Jerry Pinkney, a retelling of Puss in Boots, which he sets in 18th century France, when the original tale by Charles Perrault was first translated into English. We also have a review of Ganesha's Sweet Tooth by Sanjay Patel and Emily Haynes, which is a lighthearted take on a classic story from Hindu mythology involving the god Ganesha as a young elephant and a jaw-breaking laddu candy. The art in this one is especially nice, nodding to mid-century designers like Saul Bass. On the fiction side of things, we have a review of Elliot Schrafer's Endangered, which just yesterday was named a National Book Award finalist. It's the story of a half-American, half-Congolese girl who gets caught up in civil war in the Congo while trying to protect endangered bonobos. We also have a review of Lainey Taylor's Days of Blood and Starlight, which is the sequel to her acclaimed novel of angels fighting demons, Daughter of Smoke and Bone.
And finally, Sam, Pick of the Week is a rather sort of potentially comical memoir from a prize-winning novelist.
We went with Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Richard Russo's gracious memoir, Elsewhere, wherein the author discusses his relationship with his tenacious mother, Jean, a fiercely independent GE employee who nonetheless relied on her only son to manage her long life. When Russo moved to Tucson to attend the University of Arizona, she tagged along too on a hilarious delineated road trip in a 1960 Ford Galaxy nicknamed the Gray Death. And when Russo and his wife and family moved back east to pursue his career as an English professor and writer, Jean had to be resettled nearby. Russo's memoir is heavy on logistical detail, people moving around, houses packed and unpacked, and by turns rueful and funny, emotionally opaque and narratively rich.
Well, thanks for that, Sam Slayton, reviews editor at Publishers Weekly. We appreciate you joining us for this week's review of the reviews.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Beyond the Book is produced by Copyright Clearance Center, a global rights broker for the world's most sought-after materials, including millions of books and ebooks, journals, newspapers, magazines, and blogs, as well as images, movies, and television shows. You can follow Beyond the Book on Twitter, find Beyond the Book on Facebook, and subscribe to the free podcast series on iTunes or at the Copyright Clearance Center website, copyright.com. Just click on Beyond the Book. Our engineer is Jeremy Brisky of Burst Marketing. My name is Christopher Keneally. For all of us at Copyright Clearance Center, thanks for listening to Beyond the Book.